Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Andy Beanstock. The novel These Days takes us back to mid-1970s Baltimore and into the life of teenager Becky Schelling. Her father, a jazz trumpeter, has packed up and left town without a trace, abandoning his daughter to a less-than-affectionate stepmom and stepsister. Becky is hurt and vulnerable. Looking to fill a father-shaped void in her life, she meets a charismatic and manipulative older man, Lenny Moss. Becky falls head over heels in love with Lenny, and he responds by making her the star attraction at his new business, a strip club on the block in the city's red light district. Author Margot Christie paints the characters and setting with pinpoint accuracy, which should be no surprise. Christie was herself a teenage showgirl on the block back in the 70s, and her protagonist's journey is not so different from her own. Margot Christie joined us recently on a studio line from radio station KUVO in Denver, Colorado, to talk with producer Aaron Hankin.
Margot Christie, welcome to The Signal. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Aaron. It's nice to be here.
I want to start by having you tell the story of your own teenage years and how it was that you came to be a dancer on the block in Baltimore in the 1970s.
Well, Aaron, like Becky Schelling, the protagonist in my novel, I come from a broken home in which a certain traumatic event set the stage for other events that culminated in my landing on the block as an underage stripper. For Becky, that event was her dad's disappearance when she was 14 years old and the subsequent abuse she suffered at the hands of her stepmother, who was also abandoned by Becky's dad. For me, that event was my father's illness. When I was 6 years old, my dad suffered a massive stroke. Before the stroke, he was a good-looking, charismatic guy. He worked in regional sales for Domino Sugar in Baltimore. But after the stroke, he was partially paralyzed and his short-term memory was greatly impaired. So this depressed him a great deal. He more or less gave up on life. He became very nostalgic for the past. He also drank a lot and got into violent fights with my mom. Then, when I was 16, Mom left him, and in the process, she left my sister and me, too. Dad was already pretty tough to live with. After that, he became impossible to live with. He knew we were in touch with our mom, so he hounded us day and night for information about her. Well, after about a month or so of that, we decided to take off on our own, too. My sister went to live with some friends, and I took up with an older man. He was 26 years old to my 16. And he had a kid he never saw and a wife who'd been a stripper on the block. Within a few months of moving in with him, I was working as a stripper on the block too. He knew which clubs were good and which were sleazy, so he took me to one of the better ones, and that was the Stage Door Bar, which was located directly behind the old Gaiety Theater on Commerce Street.
Let me just ask you, if I can, what that relationship was like and what those conversations were like that convinced you that this, you know, was a good idea, a fun idea to do?
It wasn't so much that I thought it would be fun. I wasn't necessarily averse to the idea, but my boyfriend, the 26-year-old, was actually unemployed. It was the 1970s. There weren't a whole lot of jobs for guys like him. He was an unskilled laborer. So it was really economic circumstances that took me to work down the block.
You mentioned this idea of nostalgia and your father sort of becoming almost a victim of nostalgia. And it seems like you and your protagonist in this book, Becky Schelling, have this deeply ingrained drive for nostalgia, this idealizing of this not so long ago era that's come and gone. And in your novel, this nostalgia really becomes kind of a dangerous weakness for Becky. Maybe talk about what goes through the mind of a young showgirl who maybe has this romanticized idea about what she's doing compared to the reality around her.
Okay, well, let me start that conversation by saying some things about Becky's dad. Becky adores her dad. He's a jazz musician, like you said. He's also chronically living in the wrong era. It's the 1970s, and jazz has been supplanted by rock and roll, so he's underemployed or unemployed. So, much like my dad longed for the days when he had a job he loved, Ernie longs for the days when jazz was America's music and there was plenty of work for guys like him. So she comes by nostalgia quite naturally. Then, just like that, he's gone. So enter Lenny Moss. He's good-looking and charismatic like Becky's dad. And he also happens to be in the habit of romanticizing the past. He loves old style burlesque. He ignites Becky's interest in it. He likes to tell tales about the good old days, too, just like Becky's dad. He's even old enough to be Becky's dad, though he's not ancient. He's 38, very attractive, at the height of his sexual prowess. Becky falls head over heels in love with him, and in the process falls into the trap of believing that if she gives Lenny whatever he wants, if she can somehow walk on eggshells and never mess up, she can protect herself from ever being abandoned again. Now, what she's really doing is setting herself up to be abandoned. Lenny's married and he's not planning on getting divorced. But the nostalgia that she has for the lost pleasure of having her dad in her life prevents her from really seeing this. She's, in essence, replaced her dad with Lenny.
I guess this mutual lure of nostalgia that they have about the block is kind of founded by the fact that there really is kind of an amazing bona fide burlesque history to the block in its heyday. And you know these stories firsthand, Margot Christie, that the veteran folks on the block told you when you were there back in the 70s. And I thought maybe I would just give you a chance to spin a few yarns about the block, those stories that you heard that made that place seem magical to you.
Well, the block in the 70s was a very nostalgic place. Burlesque was all but dead in those years. Pornography had become legal, and it was rapidly changing the way strip joints operated. But the burlesque people were still around on the block. Retired burlesque queens like Betty, the barmaid at the stage door, were tending bar, and there were old school booking agents still around. They were no longer booking into burlesque theaters. They were booking into nightclubs across the country and some porn theaters. But they were still around. They were hanging around on the block, essentially for lack of anything better to do. These people, you have to remember, had never really done anything but work in burlesque. So though they may not have really liked the way pornography was degrading things, it wasn't like they could just go out and get another job. So they were very nostalgic people themselves. They were nostalgic for the good old days of burlesque, and they loved to spin tales about the block. They loved to talk about Blaze Starr and how things were in her day. She's probably the most famous of all the block characters. She owned the 2 o'clock club. I unfortunately never got a chance to meet her, but I used to hear about her plenty. So, I mean, her presence was very much alive on the block even after she was gone. So like I said, I came to the block from a broken home. There was a lot of chaos in my home. There was very little parenting. My sister and I were essentially allowed to do what we pleased, and boundaries were being pushed and violated all the time. So the loose morality, for lack of a better term, that I witnessed when I went to work on the block was nothing new for me. And the people there were very warm and welcoming. They became like family to me. Milton Carter, for example, the man who managed the stage door, was a strip joint manager who'd been on the block since the 1940s. He was pushing 70 by the time I showed up down there, and he became like a grandfather to me. On my very first day there, when I sat down with my very first ever customer that bought me a drink, he pulled me aside to tell me that I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to do. This was priceless information. I really didn't know what was expected of me. He also used to get on me about smoking. He warned me to stay away from certain philandering men. Now, I didn't necessarily listen, but it was nice to have someone like that in my life who at least gave me something to think about, because it was more than what either one of my parents usually did.
That's so interesting and ironic, I guess, you know, that the place where you found someone with like a protective paternal interest in your well-being was in a strip joint on the block.
Yeah, it is interesting. But, you know, I like to tell people that they were normal people. They were very marginalized, in a sense, from the rest of society. We were stigmatized. And in those days, there was kind of like this feeling of we're all in this together, you know. And so there wasn't a lot of backstabbing or backbiting. We were in it together by virtue of the fact that we were stigmatized and marginalized from the rest of society. So it really was a very warm place, and we did stick together.
From WYPR in Baltimore, this is The Signal. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with author and former block showgirl Margot Christie. She's a novelist as well these days, and in fact, that's the title of her new novel, These Days. It takes readers back to Baltimore's red light district in the 1970s. And Margot, you mentioned this sort of older, wiser, former burlesque dancer, Cookie, that young Becky meets at one point in your novel. And she says something to Becky that really, it hits her with the force of a revelation. She tells this younger dancer, It's all smoke and mirrors on the block. Nobody down there wants the real you. Talk about what this older performer means by this, and what's so important about this lesson for Becky.
Well, I see this as the point of the novel where Becky experiences some real growth. It's the point at which it hits her that her father wasn't always the man she thought he was, that his life was, in fact, one of smoke and mirrors. She gets glimmers of this throughout the novel, but it's this advice from Cookie that really opens her eyes to it. Cookie is the one person on the block that Becky learns to trust. She confides in her. And in the process, Cookie opens up to her. Cookie also has a life that she doesn't share with people on the block. And she's learned through the years of her experience that you don't give everybody everything about you, you know, that there are certain things that you reserve for certain parts of your life and other things that you reserve for other parts of your life. But she chooses to open up to Becky. So she has a really strong effect on Becky in terms of Becky's growth within the novel. And as well, this advice also opens Becky's eyes up to the fact that Lenny, the supposed love of her life, doesn't really want the real Becky. He's fine with the sexual Becky, and the one who will jump to the ceiling to please him pleases him no end. But he makes no secret of his distaste for the well-rounded Becky, the one who's sexy and pretty, but also talented and intelligent and self-determined. So it's this realization that's a real growth spurt for Becky in the novel.
Well, I obviously don't want to give anything away about your novel, about whether or not your protagonist, Becky, stays under the thumb of Lenny Moss, or whether or not she gets away from the block, whether or not she finds something else to do with her life. Readers will have to find that out for themselves. But I can say, I can say that you, Margot Christie, left the block after, what, maybe 5-6 years, and you headed west for new horizons, yeah?
Yes, that's true. I live in Denver now. Actually, though, I stripped on the block for about 10 years over a 17-year period, from 1978 until 1995. Many of those years, I only worked part-time, though. Yeah. I worked full-time at the stage door from 79 until 83, and then the rest of that time, I went back and forth from stripping to regular jobs. I put myself through college at UMBC, but even after graduating, I hung around for another 3 years. The block kind of has a way of sucking people in.
Tell me about your farewell to the block. I mean, how hard was it to give up that chapter? I mean, or were you just way over it at that point? I mean, what is, talk about the point in a young woman's life where she says, I'm done with this, and now it's time to, you know, move on and do something else.
Oh, actually, Aaron, I mean, I can say that was a pretty simple decision. I still miss the people on the block. At the time when I decided to give it up, I was actually working at Sherry's Show Bar, which is out on Pulaski Highway, but it was run much like the block. It was owned by old block people. I only worked there on weekends. I had other jobs, and I had just made a decision that at a certain point I wasn't going to do this anymore. 90% of the other women were younger than me. I was into my 30s by then. And it just wasn't working for me on an emotional level anymore.
So you're out there in Colorado now. You've got a regular day job. But as I understand it, you also continue to do burlesque dancing in some capacity, very much on your own terms, as sort of part of the neo-burlesque movement, right? Talk about this movement and what it means for you to still be strutting your stuff.
Well, it's a very self-affirming experience. Like Becky in the novel, I was always nostalgic enough to believe that there was something glamorous about stripping on the block. And in some ways it was. I did my best to keep my act classy. I had learned how to peel gloves and stockings and strip out of gowns from a lot of the older dancers. One thing I'd like to add here is that when I went to work at the stage door, I was the youngest dancer in that club for about 3 years running. The rest of them were 25, 30. Some of them were even pushing 40, and they had been around since the 60s, so they knew how to dance in the old slow tease style. And I learned from watching them. I also picked up tips from Betty the barmaid, who had been a stripper at the 408 in the 40s and 50s. So I always did work on that self-affirming aspect of it, that aspect of it that celebrates the sexual beauty of women. Even when the crowd didn't necessarily seem to want that, I was very persistent about it, that I was going to keep this an artsy thing. Yeah. Then around the year 2000, I discovered the art of new burlesque. I didn't get involved in it until about 2005, but in it I found a community of people who saw burlesque the same way I saw it. They saw it as a means of self-expression, as a way of celebrating the sexual beauty of all women, all shapes, sizes, and ethnicities. So New Burlesque has the effect of legitimizing my experience as a stripper. In reality, it wasn't always a self-affirming experience, but they in the New Burlesque community call me a baby legend. And for those who don't know what that is, that's a stripper who was around in the 70s, because the 70s are largely considered to be the last waning days of burlesque. I never considered myself to be a legend, but I am so honored that my contemporaries in the New Burlesque community see me this way.
I should say, Margot, that you have a website. It's margotchristienovelist.com, and you have on this website a blog, and you update about your travels and just thoughts about things. But I came across this really interesting post that you wrote not too long ago about the advent of the bikini swimsuit and how it spelled the doom, in a way, of old-fashioned burlesque. I wonder if you might, I'll give you a chance to philosophize here a minute on this historico-feminist thesis of yours. This is a pretty interesting perspective.
The thing that made old burlesque popular was that it came about in an era when so-called respectable women did not display their sexuality. So the only way a man could see female sexuality on display was to go to a burlesque show. And those shows were very tame by the standards of today's strip joints. In the blog article you talk about, I invoked an image of Ursula Andress in the 1962 James Bond film Dr. No. In a photo from that film, Miss Andress, who plays a shell diver named Honey Ryder, emerges from the sea holding a knife. Her hair and body are wet, and she wears no makeup. She looks very wild. And this, I'm sure, was very pleasing to men of the 1960s, but to me, there's no doubt that she would do nothing if there wasn't also pleasure in it for her, and she wasn't the type of lady who would take any crap off of men. Mm-hmm. So to me, this kind of embodied the image of a sexually empowered modern 1960s woman.
And there she is also out in the great outdoors, and in any pictures of the old burlesque dancers, it's this very private kind of smoky back room secret area. So that
absolutely. Was, yeah. If a guy wanted to see any semblance of female nudity, he had to duck into a musky theater, and now all of a sudden, all he has to do is go to a beach or anywhere outdoors for that matter.
So before I let you go, Margot, I have one more question for you. They say good writers bear all. And I wonder what makes you feel essentially more naked, taking your clothes off in front of people or writing a novel as personal and confessional as this book these days?
Well, absolutely, it's writing the novel, because even in New Burlesque shows, people are there to see me perform. They're there to see how artfully I take it off. And that's easy because I did it for so long. On the other hand, if I do a reading somewhere, there's the potential of asking a question I might not feel all that comfortable answering. I think I'm kind of getting over that. This has actually been a growth experience for me, writing this novel, and being on the radio talking about it, it's just so affirming. But without a doubt, the confessional part of talking about my life has been more difficult. One of the things I'd like to add on that theme was that I grew up in Baltimore. My entire family lived nearby. I was a stripper on the block, but I didn't go around telling people I was a stripper on the block because I didn't want to embarrass my family. My mom knew about it, but she was very ashamed of it. So my mom is gone now, by the way, so is my dad. But it's very refreshing to suddenly, after all these years, be able to talk about it and to know that people have a real interest in it out there.
Novelist and burlesque dancer Margot Christie. Her book, These Days, tells the story of a teenage dancer on the block in Baltimore's red light district during the 1970s. Margot Christie lives in Denver, Colorado now. She's joined us this week on a studio line from public radio station KUVO. But I should say Ms. Christie is headed back home here to Baltimore next weekend for a busy schedule of events, both literary and burlesque performance related, a reading and discussion Saturday afternoon, February 15th at the Litmore Literary Arts Center, another reading the next afternoon, Sunday, February 16th at Minas Gallery, and then on stage Sunday evening to take part in a neo-burlesque performance at Metro Gallery. More information about all these events at our website, wypr.org/programs/signal. And Margot Christie, I want to thank you for sharing your story and your life with us. It's been a pleasure.
It was my pleasure.